tell me, if you would, about your morning of September 11th, 2001.
Well, it started out pretty routinely. I was the vice chairman at the time. The chairman was on his way to a NATO meeting crossing the North Atlantic somewhere in an airplane. He'd left earlier that morning. And I was on my way to the Hill to do some preparatory meetings with, in this case, Senator Cleland, the senator, then senator from Georgia, about my upcoming confirmation hearing as chairman. And, you know, it was I remember vividly the day. I mean, I think most people do that day. It was just on the East Coast. It was just so clear blue skies. Temperature was perfect. I mean, it was a perfect day in every respect, best I could tell. I got to Senator Cleland's office, and as we walked into his office, they had a TV going there in the outer reception room, and it said, you know, an airplane had hit one of the World Trade Centers, and there was all sorts of speculation about what that might be. But at this time, nobody thought it was, I don't think, even a criminal act. They were just, people were puzzled in trying to figure this out. So I proceeded on in with with Senator Cleland, and we were about ready to get down to some serious conversation when word came in from the outer office that the second tower had been hit. And then we knew something was going on, and the rest of the day unfolded like that. But that was the start of the day, a fairly actually routine day, a beautiful day in terms of the weather that turned real ugly real fast.
I imagine you left Senator Cleland's office very quickly, headed back to the Pentagon. What did you find when you got back there? I imagine by the time you made it back from Capitol Hill, if I know anything about Washington, D.C. traffic, that you were there and the plane that had hit the Pentagon had already struck.
It had. And as I come out of the office, Senator Cleland's office, the first thing that I was confronted with was a phone call from General Eberhardt, who was the commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command. And he said, "Hey, Dick, we got a lot of aircraft in the system, and there's a lot of confusion over whether there's some are showing they've been hijacked. Anyway, there's just a great deal of confusion, and my recommendation is going to be we land them all, and we'll sort it out later." And so that's what they did. And I hop in the car and head back towards that. Now, that conversation would normally take place over a secure telephone. We didn't have that time. I was using my my Army aide's a cell phone to connect to General Eberhardt, actually, is how we connected. And then we raced back, and coming across the 14th Street Bridge, there was the black smoke and the flames coming out of the Pentagon. And I got to tell you, I can vividly remember it, like I think most people on that day remember the images. I can vividly remember that image and thinking to myself, is this really happening? I mean, this is the World Trade Center, both of them been struck, and now the Pentagon. It was just, it was like a very bad movie.
Having been so close to it when it happened, do you think that we now as a nation maybe are a little too far removed from it? We rarely see the images on TV or hear about it on the radio, read in papers, see on the internet, and so on. I hesitate to use the word complacent because I know too much about what people in the military and Department of Homeland Security and so forth are doing on a daily basis. But do you think the average person walking down the street doesn't think about that day and the ramifications of it as often as we maybe should?
You know, I think my personal view is that probably that most citizens don't, and maybe in a way that's good. But, I mean, there are a lot of people, as you said, in our government that care very much about this and work these issues every day. But this threat from violent extremism hasn't gone away. I mean, we're just reminded the other day about in Britain, where I think three of the folks that were putting together the plot to blow up airliners over the North Atlantic were found guilty. I mean, there have been lots of other attacks, thankfully none in the United States, since 9/11. So the threat is there. It exists. People that believe, as Al-Qaeda does and some of its allies, they would like to do away with our way of life. That's what they say, and that's what they try to do. So, no, I think the threat's there, and I think we do become a little bit complacent. And so when you turn to issues like Iraq or Afghanistan, and it goes on for some time, you know, you can see people getting impatient and wanting some sort of quick fix to a problem that is much deeper and much more complex than will yield to, I think, any quick fix.
Your official term as chairman of the Joint Chiefs began October 1st, so you're there, new on this job, obviously not new to the job, having served as vice chair, but officially in the position, just as tremendous changes are happening in the way that we view national security and the way that we execute national security. What was your role in all of that, working with the President, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and so forth?
Well, the primary role of the chairman is to provide, is the principal military advisor to the President and the National Security Council, which, of course, includes the Secretary of Defense. And that's your primary role. And the way you discharge that is working with the combatant commanders, the commanders in the field, working with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, working with the Office of Secretary of Defense's staff, formulating your best military advice, which, by the way, by law, the chairman has to reflect not just his personal opinion, but the opinions of the Joint Chiefs of Staff if they differ. And so part of your role is trying to make sure the Joint Chiefs of Staff get access to all the information they need to make appropriate decisions, and lots of meetings where we can hammer out the issues that we may have and see if we can come to some sort of agreement on what it is that military advice we're going to provide over an extended period of time. But you're right. It was 9/11 certainly defined my term as chairman and the aftermath of all that. It certainly did.
What observations do you make about the state of our national security now? Operations in Afghanistan continue. Operations in Iraq continue, although obviously not at the level that they have for the past several years, thankfully. The president has indicated a renewed emphasis on Iraq. Secretary Gates asking for more people over there. As you observe what your successor, Admiral Mullen, has done, how do you feel about the prognosis there? Are we on the right track, do you think, to be as successful in Afghanistan as we've been in Iraq?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think the work done in Iraq since I left office, for sure, and after the sectarian violence grew to such great proportions over there, that the work done by General Petraeus and others was in the field over there, the great soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen that all participate, that has helped, I think, in Iraq's case, as you mentioned, Francis, being on a fairly good path, although I think those folks that are involved still say that it's, some of it's reversible, but they seem to be making progress along almost every front. But in Afghanistan, it's a little different. The Taliban have emerged as a bigger threat, and all of a sudden, I mean, they were, when I say all of a sudden, but over some time, but they were pretty well beaten down, and they've been able to lick their wounds, if you will, and come back stronger and with more support. And I think what we're seeing in Afghanistan is the same thing we saw in Iraq. It's there's a security element. There's an element where there has to be good political development, and there's an element where they need good economic development. And all those three, if you look back at the history of insurgencies, has to proceed pretty much simultaneously if you're going to be successful. You can't just beat down insurgencies or the Taliban with military force. You can't just be successful if you develop strong economic conditions inside Afghanistan. You can't just be successful if they have a great political apparatus and good governance. So it takes all of those working together. And I think you see that in the comments made by General Petraeus and comments made by General McChrystal and comments made by Secretary Gates and the President, that it's all elements of national power have to be focused on that, in this case, international power, if we're going to be successful in Afghanistan.
General, a lot has been made about the acquisition and procurement process at the Pentagon, the civilian side. Some problems have manifested themselves on the civilian side over the years, and that's not unique to either an administration from either party. There have been some systemic issues there. Bottom line, though, do you think that the men and women at the end of the supply chain on the ground are getting what they need in sufficient quantities to do what they need to do, not just in Afghanistan, but all over the world, wherever they are?
Well, I would contend that the U.S. military is the best equipped military with the kind of equipment and all that goes with it in the world. We're the best equipped military in the world. And so, yes, I think people at the end of the acquisition pipeline get the stuff they need. Now, you can make arguments that sometimes acquisitions are delayed and maybe we don't get it as soon as we need it. But in general, the quality of the sorts of things that are given to our military men and women is is top-notch, and that's a real tribute to the acquisition system, and also, you know, the hundreds of defense contractors that work very hard to provide that equipment.
It is certainly not a big news story when something gets done for the military by a contractor on time, on budget. That's not going to make the front page of the paper or be the top story on our radio station. And I wonder, from your point of view, with your experience, if that's maybe the part of the problem is just the perception that the system is not functioning as well as it can. When I hear you say that the people are getting what they need to be able to execute,
well, it's a complex question. There certainly is usually in the debates a lot of hyperbole when it comes to defense contractors and their performance and so forth. As you know, I'm on the board of one of the large defense contractors, and I can tell you at the highest levels of the company, clearly they need to make a profit for their shareholders. That's why they do what they do. On the other hand, there is a great deal of patriotism in what they do as well, and they'll make decisions that are favor the nation many times as opposed to making the next nickel. So these are, if you go to any major contractor's plant, watch the workers work and all that sort of stuff, they are a very patriotic group, and they want to provide the absolute best equipment they can to our troops. Now, you know, it's not always a perfect system, and there are screw-ups, and there are people in any big system that are out for themselves and out to make a buck. But that's not the rule. That's the exception, and they ought to be held accountable. Oh, by the way, especially when it comes to our national security. But the vast majority are trying to do the best they can, and it's a complex system. I mean, it's a system of interaction between government and these contractors. I think Ash Carter, the new Undersecretary for Acquisition, made a speech the other day where he talked about more about the partnership between the government, the Department of Defense, and contractors. And I've always viewed it in uniform and now out of uniform that what's really required is more of a partnership, not an adversarial relationship.
I want to go back to 9/11. Do you have any particular observations that you practice each anniversary?
No, they've varied. I mean, a couple of years ago, I was involved in the dedication of the Pentagon Memorial. It was the first memorial nationally to be completed, and I was asked to be part of the ceremony that day because I was so intimately involved in that day in the Pentagon, and I was honored to do that and represent some of the folks in uniform. And the folks of that era, but other than that, no, it varies. If I'm asked to do something like that, I'm more than happy to do that. I think one of the cable news channels is having a program they'd like me to be on to talk about 9/11, and there I think I have several people on a panel and talk about 9/11, our experiences that day, and then what it means for the country. So I'm happy to do that as well. So no, I do a variety of things. I tell you, there is always, though, a lot of reverence. I can still remember the look on Admiral Vern Clark's face. He was the chief of naval operations at the time. And the airplane, the American Airlines airplane that hit the Pentagon, went right into the Navy Command Center. And he came through the National Military Command Center where I was located, and they lost over 40 people in their command center. And I can still remember the look on his face. I mean, it was just, disbelief, sadness, anguish of over losing that many people in a split second in the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia, for goodness sakes.
General, I appreciate your time very much. There's so much more that I could cover. I do want to ask you, if I could, briefly about your book, Eyes on the Horizon. When someone picks up a copy of that, what would you like them to take away from it when they're finished with it?
Well, there's a couple things. There's one is, hey, how'd this guy grow up to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? And they'll find that there was never a clear path for that to ever happen, for sure. Two, that as I focus a lot on my years as vice chairman and chairman, I think the interaction that the military has with our civilian bosses, I think it'll give them a fresh perspective on that from a very senior level, that up to now they've had to rely on pundits and other critics talking about their perception of what they thought that relationship was like. I think this gives people a different perspective and a real insight into how the military and our civilian leadership interact and work together. And then I have a chapter that looks forward on how we should deal with violent extremism. I still don't think our country is has the proper strategy to deal with the overall issue of violent extremism that in the end will make us, if we deal with it appropriately, will make us all safer and our children and our grandchildren, and that should be our objective. So there's about three pieces of the book that I hope they take away when they read it.
What are some of the core principles that you think we need to address before we can consider ourselves on the right track there?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is develop an overarching strategy to deal with violent extremism that would not be just U.S.-centric, but be international in scope, that would, as I mentioned before, focus all our instruments of national power, the military dimension, the diplomatic political dimension, the economic dimension, probably information technology and economic dimension, to deal with some of the causes of why people turn to extremism to express themselves, and why they feel that is necessary. And I have no illusions. This is not easy to come up with this kind of strategy. It is not going to be quick, but neither was our Cold War strategy. That was a 50-year strategy that eventually resulted in freedom in Eastern Europe and many other places in the world. So here's, and it, you know, that whole Cold War containment strategy worked. And we need a similar strategy, I think, to deal with violent extremism. It's not going away. Almost any day you can pick up the newspaper and see that there's been another attack by violent extremists somewhere using terrorist methods to intimidate or try to change the political dynamics in a particular country. So this is not going away. It's something we need to deal with, and I don't think we've taken the strategic approach we need to take.
General Richard Myers, thanks to you and thanks to your family for your service to our country, sir.
Francis, thank you very much, and I appreciate the chance to be on with you.